Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.
Time to, as we always do on a Monday, kick off the week with looking at some stories from the weekend. Today, our guest is the historian, author, and the man behind the Irish History podcast, Finn Dwyer. Finn, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Sean. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming into us. So, for people who've never heard of the Irish History podcast, what's different about it?
I would hope it makes Irish history accessible by focusing on, I suppose, people rather than dates. So I think everyone is probably scarred by history in school with endless dates and a lot of often boring men, usually, actually. And what I try to do is dig out people that we probably haven't heard of, people who lived maybe, you know, on the that are forgotten by history books, be it like working class people, women, whatever, you know, people tend not to feature in the grand narratives that generally focus on men. And people usually find that, I think, more engaging and also maybe easier to remember. It's easier to remember a story than a date.
Well, yeah.
I certainly find that.
And is it difficult to kind of find those stories, you know, to find out about the people who were walking down a Connell Street on the day of 1916 rather than people who were in the GPO?
Yeah, it can be. Or certainly it's hard to find out maybe more than, you know, these people will have a passing glance with history. Maybe they were arrested and you've got that one record of like a description in a prison record or something of them. And then you have to try and dig down, maybe find them in parish records, newspaper articles where, you know, the one good thing about there's a lot of, you get a lot of criminal records online now, and a lot of people, surprisingly enough, end up before a court at one time or another, whether it's register a dog's name or sometimes something more interesting.
Right. Okay. And does that give, because I suppose a lot of the history we learned at school is kind of two dimensional in the sense, it's almost like the sense there are goodies and baddies, and life is far more complicated than that.
Yeah, for sure. Like, and I think particularly like what I'm focusing at the moment is the War of Independence. And we have this like really, I think, as you say, two dimensional view of that. Either you were on one side or the other. And like everyone thinks that their, you know, grandfather was in the GPO in 1916. When the reality is that most people didn't, and, you know, weren't directly involved. And, you know, they were supportive, but they may have had more nuanced positions, that they were supportive of some aspects of the war, weren't comfortable with other aspects. And a lot of times those people are more interesting. And, you know, people don't always voice those opinions, but you can find them. You know, when I was researching the end of World War One, I found a woman in Sligo who attacked Republicans in the town. Now, the woman had a drink problem because you could see that she'd been in the court on numerous occasions beforehand. But then when you dug down, you could see that she actually had a son who'd been killed in the First World War. So you start to get a sense there that, you know, for her, this is not a political, you know, or it's not necessarily a political view for her. It's a very traumatic thing to see what she would have seen as people maybe besmirching the memory of her son or her husband and also fought. And I think, you know, those things maybe bring it into perspective that, you know, I suppose that question, how would we react in those situations? Everyone likes to think that they'd be like maybe walking across a hill with a rifle in hand, but like the reality is that it's always a lot more complex, you know.
And that's an interesting example, given that it's still taking us some time to come to terms with the fact that Irish people served in World War One and World War Two, and you know that they did it for pretty good reasons, but we have a difficulty still with kind of commemorating those people.
Yeah, and I think, like, people can be complex and hold what are often, like, lots of ideas. So, like, someone could fight in, like, Tom Barry is probably the classic example. Tom Barry fought for the British Army in the First World War, but then would go on to become one of the most famous IRA commanders in the War of Independence. Whereas I think we have this idea that people hold these views, never change them, and you can draw lines forward and back in their life and they'll always be consistent. But if we look at our own lives, you know, we're always shaped by experiences, changes, like, you know, we've just lived through COVID. You know, that's obviously going to change lots of our views.
I love your optimistic way of putting that in the past tense. fingers crossed that is the case. Actually, what you're talking about there is, because this is one of the stories you did pick out as well, because that service commemorating the foundation of Northern Ireland is taking place this week, and from a and it seems to have been boiled down to a very black and white discussion as to who should be there or shouldn't there. From a historian's point of view, I imagine it's a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, but I think with any of the events that have become controversial in the last, whatever it is now, 2 years, year and a half, around the War of Independence, the most important thing is that we'd have a discussion about what actually happened.
Mm.
In this instance, it doesn't seem to be there's going to be any discussion about the foundation of Northern Ireland and the processes that led to that. Now, if you actually look at the history of this, there's extreme violence, sectarian violence in like the shipyards in Belfast. You can see clearly in London that they're planning to create this highly unequal state. And I think often, you know, we have this situation now where all the focus has become around people attending or not attending, when, you know, maybe it kind of lends credence to, I think, a bit maybe of people critical of the event and saying we're not learning anything at all. Mm. And I think it's important that we don't just go have an event to mark the foundation and the centenary of Northern Ireland without actually trying to understand what actually happened there. Because I think, and it's that of everything, arguably, in terms of the War of Independence, is important, because that's going to be a very important question, because whether we like it or not, there's going to be conversations about a 32-county Ireland, and those questions that are definitely, you know, that they had, because that they had a huge influence on the history of this island moving forward, are arguably more important than Collins or Dev or any of that kind of stuff. The sectarian violence in the six counties was obviously hugely important in terms of shaping the Troubles later on. And I think it's very important to try and tease that out. And I suppose for me, what stuck out about that service that's going to take place on Thursday in Armagh is that there's no forum for that. There's going to be no examination. And, you know, it would be far more useful to have, you know, Republicans and Unionists or whoever make the case either way, you know,
yeah,
and say, but at least tease out some of this stuff. I don't think anyone is any the wiser.
That's interesting. And I suppose one could say, and I certainly don't have an opinion on this one or the other, but given a lot of the peace process, a large element in that was constructive ambiguity. A large element of that was forgetting about history. That sometimes you might need to do that, especially in a place like Northern Ireland where everybody is marked by it.
Yeah, I don't know how useful it is though to forget history. I think it's about the way we approach it, because it exists there. It's not like by forgetting it or pretending it doesn't exist doesn't make it not so. And, you know, like just today you can go up like to Belfast, there's quote unquote peace walls dividing two communities. We have to understand why that's the case. Now there, the story of them is a much more recent development, but my point is saying sectarianism exists and don't apply a history to it, I don't think we'll ever get around it. We need to understand why it's there, and I'm not saying we need to be going, you did this, and like holding people to account 100 years later. That's not what I'm saying. But having a conversation around it, I think, is what will allow people at some point to move forward. I'm not convinced that like having that conversation is somehow a bad step, you know?
Yeah.
I think it'll happen anyway if we don't discuss it openly to some lad in a pub after
15 minutes. Oh, no, well, I mean, of course it will happen anyway. But I suppose the danger is, how do you find a way of having those conversations where it doesn't immediately become antagonistic, where it doesn't immediately turn into whataboutery?
Yeah, like the one thing I would say is, by not having the conversation and having an event that doesn't have the conversation is in its own way writing a history that's non-controversial. You know, that's another version of it. Oh, well, it wasn't that controversial. It's like, well, it kind of was. So I think on that, we can't escape the past. And we have to, as uncomfortable as it is, and, you know, there's lots of questions that, like, you know, we always focus on, or, well, we don't always focus, but there's a lot of focus, say, on sectarian violence in the six counties. There's lots of questions that we need to look at in terms of the southern state that emerged as well. But I think shying away from poking into these like darker recesses of the past, I don't think it gets us anywhere by not having those conversations. How to have them, that's a separate question, and that's a difficult one.
So do you think Michael D was right not to go?
The
Shinner is less of a surprise, really, but no, that would have been a story. Now, you did mention COVID, and it's still a bit up in the air. We're going to find out, I suppose, maybe even today, what it is they're going to decide.
Oh, someone will leak it, surely.
Well, they leak four different versions of it, actually. Yeah, that's the problem. But this would affect you, because people in the podcast world, you don't really make that much money from podcasting per se. It's events that you have.
Yeah, like I think it's probably, it's not as important, I think, for most people as it would be in live music. But yeah, it is very important in terms of live podcasts, and they had become, I suppose, podcasting really came about or came into its own maybe around 2016, and live shows became part of it from then on. Obviously, they haven't been able to happen because of COVID. It was funny, I had a conversation, and no one else actually really talked about this, but I had a conversation. I did a live event in of sorts. I kind of teamed up with them, Damien Lawler and Miriam Ryan, who do a tour in Croaghan about a bog body that was found there. And we did kind of a live event on Croaghan Hill, which is out in the... But anyway, people came to that, and there was a guy there who was saying to me, he was like, oh, it's great that nerds can finally meet up again and have conversations and that nobody was talking about the nerds being able to, like, meet up. Everyone was talking about live music. But obviously that hasn't been able to happen. And I think one thing I would say about the whole... I'm trying to plan an event on November the 6th, for example, and... the way politicians approach this, everyone wants to be on the right side of it. So last week we had a raft of government politicians come out and almost promise us that things would be okay. Mm. Micheál Martin did an interview then in the Sunday Independent yesterday that started to indicate that might not be the case. And then any doctor that seems to comment is saying you'd be bonkers to do this. But I think the problem is that politicians really aren't helping, and they're all going to do the same tonight once they get their hands on the Neffert briefing, presumably they'll leak that to whatever journalist on Twitter, and then everyone on Twitter will become an expert in epidemiology.
Oh, no, they all are. Really. Yeah, I don't know why we're leaving it up to Neffert at all.
But I think, yeah, the government's approach through all this has been really unhelpful in terms of the way they've handled it. It'd be better not to speculate, I think, rather than constantly giving people... You know, everyone wants to be seen to be, oh yeah, I'm trying to open up the country. It's like going, well, look, you made a mess of the health service over the last 20 years. That's one of the main reasons we can't open this country, because we don't have a functioning health service. And instead of that, they kind of won't, you know, they talk about how they're going to be the person to open things up. And I think it'd be better if they didn't say anything than never present the advice and then they act on that rather than this constant kind of speculation.
Well, I think for a while, that's what Neffert were for. They could hide behind Neffert for a long time. And then the fact that they were hiding behind Neffert became an issue, that Neffert were apparently running the country. And so then they had to pretend that they were running the country again. And now you're back with, oh, we're not going backward, we're going forward, but we mightn't do anything new. You know, kind of, you know, word salad type statements.
Yeah. I have to say, I found politicians through COVID being thoroughly uninspiring in terms of the way they've dealt with it. There's not been, we hear a lot of talk about leadership. They didn't take very many hard decisions. They took the decisions that were often the ones that people wanted to hear, like our meaningful Christmas last year.
Yeah, that turned out really well.
I think Brendan O'Connor was writing about a meaningful Halloween.
Oh God, let's hope not. Look, we are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. We do have to take a break. We'll chat more with Finn Dwyer after this. 53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. The historian, author and podcaster Finn Dwyer is still with us. We've been talking about some stories from the weekend. A couple of comments on that. Brendan says, the problem with sectarianism will never be solved if there isn't more integration in schools. But there continues to be such opposition to this. It just baffles people in the South. That's a pretty reasonable point, I would have thought. The integration in schools is minimal in the North.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
Although, yeah.
The issue is that, and on COVID, the issue is that Neffert are not an elected body. They don't represent the people. The government has to start interpreting rather than following their advice, says Maureen. What does that mean, Maureen? Who knows what that means? Sure, we'd all, the will of the people would be, we'll get rid of Neffert and go and have a big, get rid of COVID and go and have a big party. But, you know, it depends. You can't really do that. John says, how very refreshing to hear the idea behind the 100-year-old partition as the six counties, because that is what it is. It is not Ulster, it's not Northern Ireland, and it's certainly not standalone, says John, who obviously has quite strict views about that kind of thing. As now, and I suppose maybe it's a somewhat Dublin-centric story, so maybe people outside Dublin are less kind of exercised about it, but the controversy, particularly over the cobblestone pub and sticking another, even though it might, the way I'm phrasing that, sticking another hotel on top of it, do we need more hotels? Do we, like, are we going, like, the thing is the cobblestone pub, so they say is structurally not in a great, now they're going to retain it, but we need to do something with these buildings.
I think Dublin has lots of buildings like that are, you know, something needs to be done with, or maybe but I think the problem is we're kind of slowly, one by one, adding these hotels in Dublin. There's seems to be no grand plan except build more hotels in a general sense. On a personal level, like, I think the cobblestone is actually a very important thing, far beyond the pub, because I saw people on Twitter kind of going, oh, it's You know, I was in the smoking area there and it looks like a whatever. And but the cobblestone, I think, has been very important for the cultural life of Dublin. Like, for example, when I was starting off as a historian, I was they were very supportive in some of the stuff that I was doing. I was able to launch my two books there. I was involved with a local history project and I was able to start walking tours there. And they were always really accommodating of that. And obviously then there's the great musical tradition in the pub as well. And I think it reflects a broader problem in Dublin. There's no sense of, or there's no questioning of what the city is. It's like, if you strip out all these cultural institutions, like the cobblestone, where it's far more than just a pub.
Yeah, and,
you
know, sure. Like,
what are, I think Una Mullally was saying it last week, what are people coming to Dublin for? To look at other hotels and, you know, maybe Facebook's head office and things like that. That Dublin doesn't have some of the, maybe the attractions that other European capitals has. And if it keeps going the way it's going, Dublin is just going to become a gateway to Connemara. Like, people will fly in and leave straight away. Like, even there's the talk, obviously, of the development in Temple Bar. Now, Temple Bar obviously wouldn't be a place where Irish people, I think, socialise that much because of just generally. Like, it is what it is. But you plonk a hotel on Merchant's Arch, it might be a place that tourists don't even want to go to.
Yeah, like, yeah.
And I think it is this questioning, though, Dublin has to be a place where people can live in. Like, I left Dublin, I lived here for nearly 20 years and I left in 2018. And even when I come back up now, like, the change that's happening at the moment is extremely fast. Now, change is not necessarily a bad thing, but it looks like what's going on in Dublin is disastrous. Like, oh, these endless hotels. Like, who's going to stay in these hotels? And like, I was talking to with a friend of mine over the weekend and he was saying, like, where's the next Paddy Maloney going to be kind of, you know, get his break? Because if places like the Cobblestone are gone, you're just going to have, like, I don't know, loads of hotels. Like, I don't know, is the next, I don't know who the next...
And places like the Cobblestone were thin on the ground as it was anyway. I mean, the Cobblestone was pretty unique.
Yeah, hopefully we'll be able to say the Cobblestone is pretty...
Actually, no, my point being there should be more Cobblestones, or there should have been more Cobblestones anyway.
There definitely should. And I think the plan of what they have to do there is, like, to build this hotel around it and actually on top of the pub as well. Like, it's just, you know... Obviously, the historian says, "Oh, preserve it." But if it's almost like if you're going to do that, just, like, you know, don't bother. Like, that's such that's pity. Like, just don't bother. You're not preserving
but
it.
But actually, it's because it kind of almost changes the relationship with it. Because what is seen to be an authentic part of Dublin, an authentic part of Irish culture, suddenly has a facade stuck around it, and it renders the whole thing fake. Then it's like a tourist attraction rather than a place where genuine musicians go and genuine fans of music go.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to, like, if they go ahead with this, like, the Cobblestone is not going to be able to function the way it, you know, because it's one of those things. It's very hard to, you can't build the kind of cultural scene in a pub. If you take that and open up a pub down the road and call it the Cobblestone, it's not going to be the same. You know, like, that place is built up its identity and stuff like that over the last 20, 30 years. And yeah, I think the thing is, I don't know if the planners are fully aware, but they obviously must be. But, like, when this is done, you can't undo this. It's going to reshape Dublin for decades, what's happening at the moment. Like, you know, you could see it with, say, with the destruction of George in Dublin in the 70s, the legacy of that was felt, you know, and tourists who come to Dublin don't have the same variety of things they have in other European capitals. Now, Dublin is a smaller city, but at the rate they're going, they're just going to strip them out too. And, like, you know, as, you know, that article said, they'll be in hotel rooms looking out at other
hotel rooms. Yes, or it'll be whatever you came to see 2 years ago is being knocked down and replaced with a hotel. And I suppose similarly with the, but what interested me about the merchant about the Merchant's Arch thing as well was that so many people seem to be, well, this is on social media, of course, but so many people were reacting that it's a bit of a dump anyway. So it's like we don't value this.
Yeah, no, I think there is, I think there's two contrasting things. Though. Like, say, for example, the buildings maybe beside the Cobblestone, you're going, oh, something could be done with them. That is true. It doesn't have to be another hotel, though. Or those buildings, like, around Merchant's Arch, maybe they do need work on them. But again, maybe you can just restore the buildings that are there rather than plough in some, and you just know it's going to be awful. Like, it's just, like, I'm not an architect, but I just know what it'll be, because building in Dublin at the moment is just, yeah, it's, I think, but it does come back to a much deeper problem that what is the vision of what Dublin is going to be in 20 years' time? Like, where are the areas of the city where, you know, culture and, you know, is it just a tourist will come in and there'll just be loads of shops and there's, you know, and if that is it, put it to people. But like, people can't live between the canals now, and that's becoming a really big problem. Mm. That like, you need to be earning huge money to live between the canals. And so like, you'd wonder, like in winter in particular, will the city centre become quite a vacant place? Because people obviously won't want to be travelling miles at night, so there won't be people around, in maybe the same way as like Grand Canal Dock or some of those places can be quite dead at night.
Yeah.
You'd wonder whether the entire city centre become like that if this trajectory continues.
Yeah. Catherine says, I think it's devastating what's being done to Dublin's history and culture. There will be nothing left. Your guest is right. What will draw people here in another few years? Nothing. What we pride ourselves on, our arts and culture, is just being torn to shreds. Sarah says, Cork City seems to be building more offices and hotels and places to live. The demolition of the Sextant Bar is a case in point, she says. But this is, behind all this is, people are building hotels. Obviously developers are building hotels because there's money in it. That's really what underlines all this. Really, it's an ideological thing rather than any, and it's the prevailing ideology of our government.
Oh, for sure, and like, to a degree, I don't actually blame the developers. You know, it's kind of like the thing of like the scorpion biting you. You can't blame the scorpion. Like, it's that there's, and it comes back to this wider plan. Like, there should be a limit. Like, how many hotel rooms does Dublin need? Then you come up with a number and you work off that instead of going anyone who wants to have a go. Like, you know, and in the weird response, what he claims was like irony or whatever, that from Owen Keegan encouraging the students' union to get in on it. Like, you know, it's like, that's not the way we should be going. You know, not like, should everyone in Ireland then just start becoming a hotel owner? Like, you know, it's, I don't know. It's, we are going to be left though with a city that, like, and this has happened to Dublin on several other occasions in its history that have been devastating. You can look back into the 18th century when Dublin became a bit of a kip in the 19th century because. Mm. Of the lack of any kind of investment in the city in a coherent way. And you'd wonder, yeah, where will Dublin be in 30, 40 years? And particularly, you know, I think there's going to be huge changes in the economy as well in those 30, 40 years. Yeah, I'd fear certainly for the city centre in terms of what that's going to become and why anyone would want to be coming there other than business to work in maybe a Facebook office.
Finn, plug your two live events and where can people get tickets for them? God willing.
You can get the one is in Liverpool, so I don't think, as good and all as the show is, I don't think people are going to come to Liverpool. It's on in the Medieval Mile Museum on November the 6th in Kilkenny, and you can get tickets at historyshow.eventbrite.com.
Okay, good stuff. And just also be advised that Finn will not invest in a new hotel project. Finn Dwyer, thanks a million for coming into us today. That's Finn Dwyer there, the historian, author and podcaster. You are listening to The Moncrief Show on News Talk. We're going to take a break after that. How the cheese grater changed the world.
Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.